1970s was one of the literary world's most tantalizing mysteries. Nobody seemed to know what had happened to her and why, the general belief being that she'd found religion, shut herself away, and become a recluse. All her books were out of print, and she was said to have disowned everything she'd written as a kind of parting shot. Her poetry couldn't be republished without her permission. But poets continued to be fascinated by her work, and in 2009, Radio 4 broadcast a half-hour programme about her in the Lost Poets series, called The Poet Who Vanished, presented by Brian Patton, which included some bizarre theories as to her whereabouts. One contributor to the programme imagined her living then in Cuba, smoking cigars in a doorway, which might sort of fit with that illustration. Other commentators over the years made her into a nun, consigned her to a sect, had a communion with the ghost of Charles Baudelaire, or put her in a shed at the bottom of someone's garden. And for some reason, these mythmakers always required her to be living in poverty. Having tried to visit her myself 5 years earlier, I was aware that her actual situation was rather different from what everyone had imagined. Apart from her family, I was probably the only person who knew what had happened to Rosemary Tonks. But when asked to contribute at the last minute to the Lost Poets programme when they discovered this connection, I could only confirm that she was still alive, and out of respect for her declared wish, maintained by her family, that she should be left in peace, I could give no details of where she was living, continuing to nurse the hope that with encouragement she might one day relent and allow her poetry to be republished. Any publicity she found would have made that impossible, because she would have regarded that as quite intrusive. But I was also unaware at that time, as were her family, that while she had been living alone since her disappearance, she was far from being a recluse. And also, she would never have agreed to the republication of her work. So the mystery remained, as far as the programme's listeners and the literary world were concerned. As Brian Patton put it, Rosemary Tonks evaporated into the air like the Cheshire Cat. And not only did Rosemary Tonks disappear, so did her books. They disappeared from the shelves of bookshops and libraries. Who was stealing them? Poets wanting their own copies of her two rare collections? Or was it Tonks herself, in disguise, removing every copy she could find from circulation, because she was renowned at that time for burning copies of her books? And it got to the stage where book dealers were asking for £1,500 for the few remaining copies of her two poetry collections still in circulation. And yet she had been discussing the republication of her work as late as 1978 with a small press run by the poets John Moat and John Fairfax. And that's part of their correspondence, something she wrote to her about the books, which makes it clear that she didn't actually suppress those two books. They went out of print, but then later she talked to them about republishing her work, and then later changed her mind completely and then wanted to stop anything of hers being published. That selection would, I'm sure, have included these two poems.
Poet as Gambler. Now, like a gambler on an errand of my wasted youth, when gutter and heavens were my lottery, and my estate a shirt of water lotus that the night wind loved to rock as I went to do my gambling alone at dusk in the dark city to outbid eternity, with nothing but a blouse of lilies flooding my lapel, a wallet stuffed with fever for my stake. All night until the early hours, when stowaways will grope for the unknown and illustrate their clothes with lustrous bruises as they go aboard, and all the ropes and fabrics of a boat are heavy with cold nectars in the dawn, creation glimmering and surly underfoot, and Egypt drowsy on a cake of opium. I went with nothing but the shirt upon my back to cast lots with the infinite, and my bid was the blouse that rocks on gamblers with a linen sail all night. Poet as gambler.
We've had that. Sorry. This is a bit difficult to operate this thing.
It is the street. Bedouin of the London morning. We come into the cafe at dawn. There are water fogs and civilization is white. If you knew the exotic disgust that grips me after another bestial night, as we come in broken, dark with inks and dusts and gases, like those whose private apartment is the street. After an all-night conversation, when the street wind hangs on snarling to your coat, if you knew my half-erotic convulsion of loathing for the night. I'm like a sleeper when his mouth is stopped up by some terrible mud crust the dream has crammed there, and the soul goes pressing up against, trying to scream with hydrophobia, and can only murmur. Some love thought turns his mouth to blood with longing only a moment later. In the workman's cafe, if you knew the almost voluptuous sense of frustration when you're broken and the morning's alcoholic as a lily.
When you're broken and the morning's alcoholic as a lily. Rosemary Tonks did become broken. She began to break down within a few years of making that recording. To discover how and why, we need to wind the clock back in true mystery story fashion. So cue flashback from the foggy streets and cafes of 60s Soho to pre-war England. We're now in 1928. Rosemary Tonks is born in Gillingham, Kent, and not in 1932, as was said in all her biographical notes. She's the only daughter of Gwendolyn Ney Verdi and Desmond Tonks, a mechanical engineer who died from Blackwater fever in Nigeria before she was born. Rosemary later claims descent via her mother from the composer Giuseppe Verdi, whom she referred to in a letter to a friend as her grandfather's uncle. Born on the 10th of a certain powerful month, and I was born on the 17th of that same month. He had to have his own way in order to transform Italian opera. And I inherit one or two physical features and other hidden stubborn traits connected with having my own way. Her family isn't sure about this connection. Age 16, she's expelled from school. Or maybe she made that up. The family also disagree about that one. Rosemary was a storyteller. And with Rosemary Tonks, we're never sure what's true and what's fanciful. But as you'll discover if you read Bedouin of the London Evening, she always had identity issues. Her own diary comment on her upbringing reads, "No sense of self." But we do know this. In 1949, she marries, age 20, Mickey Lightband, an engineer whose work takes them to India and Pakistan. And the two bridesmaids and the page boy are here in our audience. I'll just spare them that. In Pakistan, she contracts paratyphoid fever in Calcutta, followed by polio in Karachi. We're now in 1952. Sorry, that wasn't Pakistan, that was Calcutta, anyway. Recovering from paralysis in England, she's left with a slightly withered right hand. Such is her determination, she teaches herself to write and paint with her left hand and takes to wearing a rakish black glove over the other. And this is a recently discovered picture of Rosemary at a family event with her husband, Mickey, and Aunt Tinker, taken 5 years later in 1957, where you can see the black glove hiding the appliance on her right hand. Now back to 1952, Mickey's still in Pakistan. She goes to live in Paris alone. She said, "In illness you want to be alone, and England was full of relations. Living for a year on the Île de Saint-Louis, close to the spirits of Baudelaire and Rambo, she's able to immerse herself in Parisian culture and French literature." One of the few surviving photographs of her shows a chicly dressed, slender young woman standing in front of Rodin's Stendhal monument in the Jardin de Luxembourg. Only her left hand is showing here. On a later visit to Paris in 1967, the centenary of Baudelaire's death, she goes to pay homage to the poet in Montparnasse Cemetery, lying down beside his life-size effigy on the Baudelaire monument to confirm that they were the same height. And over an 11-year period, from 1963 to 74, Rosemary Tonks publishes two epoch-defining poetry collections, Notes on Cafes and Bedrooms in 1963 and Iliad of Broken Sentences, 1967, as well as six acerbic satirical novels and a number of short stories. Interviewed in 1967, she declared her direct literary forebears to be Baudelaire and Rambo. "They were both poets of the modern metropolis as we know it, and no one has bothered to learn what there is to be learned from them. The main duty of the poet is to excite, to send the senses reeling." In sharp contrast with the traditional, well-behaved, dry, self-deprecating verse being published at that time by most of her English contemporaries, her poetry, as you will have heard, is declamatory, bold, spirited, extravagant, and exuberantly sensuous. A hymn to 60s hedonism set amidst the bohemian nighttime world of a London reinvented through French poetic influences and sultry oriental imagery. In another interview, she discussed her views on poetry with Peter Orr, and we'll now hear the first 4 minutes of that interview, which was from 1966.
The Poet Speaks. In this program, Rosemary Tonks talks to Peter Orr.
But I think it diabolical, this getting of a poet out of his or her back room and making them into public figures who have to give opinions every 20 seconds. I know this is what the French do. I don't approve of it.
You don't think it helps, do you, for a poet to talk direct to his public other than through his poetry?
Well, I avoid this on every possible occasion. First of all, because it means a loss of something like 2 weeks' work, during which I worry about it, and then I get over it. When one's writing, one's an introvert. When one goes onto a stage, one must make oneself into an extrovert.
And unless, I suppose, one's a Dylan Thomas kind of person who enjoys that sort of thing.
Yes, but it killed him, eventually, because the enormous strain of each performance, for a man who was both, of course, but who found it progressively more strenuous, and who wrote less and less poetry, so that every time he went on a stage, he knew that he was giving up another poem, practically. You either read and you give talks and you become a public person, or else you write consistently and every day and very well and think on a certain level. You can't go back to that deep level of thinking if you're too much a social person.
Does this deep level of thinking preclude the idea of an audience?
I could communicate if only the English weren't quite so English. But you know they don't finish their sentences. And anyway, they're not passionately concerned with their subject. And so the conversation tends to turn into a series of already hammered out academic platitudes, which means to say you're not going to break fresh ground. You're only going to exchange academies.
Does this mean you keep away from the society of other poets as far as you can?
No. I try to seek it out. At one time, of course, when I was alone, I frightfully wanted to meet other poets. Now I go and meet them occasionally as a duty, but they're rather a lost set, you know, here in London, because they tend to group together for strength. They form movements. They're afraid of being alone.
Do you feel, then, that contemporary poetry now is a bit of a dead end, then?
It could be a great deal more exciting. I don't understand why poets deliberately are quite ready to pick up trivialities, but are terrified of writing of passions. And remember, it was Stendhal who was praising Byron at the time, because he said, well, here is a great contemporary who writes of human passions, and this is something which has completely gone out of fashion, if you like. You could write of feeling, or you could write of if you were disgruntled in present day. This is quite enough to carry a poem. so current thought has it. You can have a tiff with your wife, and that's enough. But all the really tremendous feelings you live by have been ignored, or people just get round them.
So the real poetry to you is a kind of elemental poetry?
Dealing with the things which really move people. People are born, they procreate, they suffer, they're nasty to one another, they're greedy, they're terribly happy, they have changes in their fortune, and they meet other people who have effects on them, and then they die, and these thousands of dramatic things happen to them, and they happen to everybody. Everybody has to make terrible decisions, pass examinations, or fall in love, or else avoid falling in love. All these things happen, and contemporary poets don't write about them. Why not?
You don't feel now that we're more conscious, say, than people were 200 or 300 years ago, of the world around us, the world outside us, of things which are happening in the world, like starvation and a trite thing, again, to say, the shadow of the hydrogen bomb.
I think they're academically conscious of these things, and that's no bad thing, because to be conscious of them at all is very important. But that's a dry consciousness, which... Mass starvation is an enormous theme, and you need a large soul to be able to tackle it. You can't tackle it with a trivial, offhand sensibility.
You mean you have to be able to comprehend this fact of mass starvation and to feel it?
You must feel it, otherwise how are you going to make a poem about it? It's better...
Sorry, need to carry on. She said there, all these things happen and contemporary poets don't write about them. Why not? They may not have done in 1966, but she did. And of course, poets do just that now. Rosemary Tonks was ahead of her time, at least in British poetry. Also, in 1965, she made an experimental poetry and sound piece called Sonomontage for the Hampstead Festival, which was reworked the following year for the BBC, some of which you'll hear later. She's now a singular figure in London's artistic circles, a world she portrays with both relish and distaste in her sharply observed semi-autobiographical novels. She lives a literary life in Hampstead with Dame Edith Sitwell as a neighbour and parties with many other celebrated writers and artists. And that such a lively, forthright poet might have given up literature for God and become a recluse is beyond anyone's comprehension.
The solitary's bedroom. Now for the night, liquid or bristling, when owls make the ink squeak at my window, and my bedroom, that can burn my body of its will, drinks out my brains on pillows. Like a bather, caught and skinned by rollers, I shall toss for an eternity in surf, when the air-eating spirit in my nostrils is maddened by its heavy coat of earth. Now for your rest, eyes where my passions lay, waterlogged in flashing muscles all day, well below the waterline and plotted in their acids, salt mortis sets your lids. Baked on hell's rubbish heap, I go on smouldering, with my spirit at its bread of breath, incapable of beating out the flames. And hatches are raised cautiously by all the senses. Oh, once you have taken this draught of black air, you would be glad of infinity to get your bearings.
I'm going to play four poems. This is the second, if I can get it to work.
The Flâneur and the Apocalypse. For his inebriated tread, the whole of Europe, with its great streets full of air and shade, its students and cocottes, and traffic roughly caked with blood, is not enough. The whole of Europe put to sleep by music coal fire, snow and cafe life, and suffocated by hot fogs and poppies, and rocked by lovers like a chest of breath, is not for the flaneur drug strong enough. A Europe motionless with dust and night, as if a squid her bag had emptied, as if a doormat had been shaken over it, is not mysterious enough for his infatuated dread. The Furies are modern. They don't drive you, they entice, with cafes, lovers, dusty streets, with the apocalypse. Not this one, but the next, they hiss. Gutter Lord. I knew the poet's rag-soft eyelid was the gutter's fee for the way down to life. I had my lodgings in that quarter of the city, like a cat's ear, full of cankered passages, where November wraps the loiterer as spiders do their joints. I was apprenticed to the moth bred from my clothes. Gold sail folded up, for with her tread as prints of footpads I could take my own grave unawares, or when my head was baked with Jewish magic, stalk the archangel, thy insect, he whose nest is thatched to ride the juice and fire of storms. I was no merchant who for passport strokes a pearl. Only those who trade their rag-lid of bright lashes may business in the supernatural with the gutter for a dress. My gutter, how you gleamed! Like dungeon floors which cobras have lubricated, your time was kept in slimy yawns, while you prized up the warm roof of the poor man's shoe and lacquered it with mire, that the grave might find a way in to its meat. Meanwhile, the fool readored, his face green as a toad, seen in a rippling crack of rain. The grave, whose grunt lifts the latch, whose leavings, found at night upon my flank, were as black bread and smoked like Satan's droppings. Oh, heaven was greedy at my nostril, dark as a violet, to draw out her own breath from my brute, freeze it with winter while I slept, and with it bolt me to the ground in linen and diamond. Fog peacocks. We were the city's young, and our veins, if they ran pale from the bad food, even so they carried the infernos of its moods, for we were the children of the rotting peacock of a passer-by, seen in a mist of scorching bitumen. Oh, you bound homeward when the cloud of gold gas shone behind the house, with a captured insect, once half helium, now only spurs and gauze, and the green liquor pool in jars of glass. We were not less whose city, like an alcohol, spoke hotly to the artery, and we already knew love's streets, where at the fall of thermal, phosphorescent dusk, there is a drop that goes down sheer to hell. Those evenings you were mutinous against the tyranny of kitchen tables, where the flat iron cools its mirror of blue ore and grip of hot rag, and the old blanket smokes like humus. We were the young, derisive metropolitans, soon to be mashed flat as a wet coal sack by skies of ochre, full of malice, coating the trees with emulsion, and you would have to drag for our disgust in sewers, and break the cobwebs reaching an illusion.
We were the young, derisive metropolitans, soon to be mashed flat as a wet coal sack by skies of ochre full of malice. You would have to drag for our disgust in sewers. That's where she was then. Her last novel, The Halt During the Chase, appears from Bodley Head in 1972, and in 1974 she publishes a remarkable essay on Colette in the New York Review of Books. 2 years later, she writes a peculiar guest column in The Times in May 1976 called On Being Down But Not Quite Out in Paris, an account of the year she spent during the early 50s in a garret on the Ile de Saint-Louis, as her character guided in The Halt During the Chase, that last novel. And then nothing more is heard from her for the next 40 years, until May last year, when The Guardian publishes my obituary of her, followed by a fuller account in an article I wrote for the paper. So what happened to Rosemary Tonks? There are no photographs of Rosemary from the period after her disappearance, the last 35 years of her life. She also destroyed all the earlier photographs she possessed. Two of the pictures reproduced in the book only survived by a happy accident. I found one of them, Rosemary pictured in 1952, hidden inside the backing of a framed photograph, along with other family pictures. The framed photograph, showing her with a friend in 1948, when she would have been about 20, had slipped down the back of a piece of furniture and was only found by chance by the auctioneers some months after her death. The point being that these were photographs of Rosemary Tonks, and Rosemary Tonks, the writer, had ceased to exist. The former Rosemary Tonks didn't just destroy all her writings, she destroyed all images of her past self. Her poetry may have been inspired by Rambo, one of her literary heroes, but her disappearance was not. However, like Rambo, she did travel, and to the Middle East, for which she needed a passport, but her last passport has the photograph ripped out. And even in her 70s and 80s, she always paid for her travel in cash. She couldn't have a bus or rail pass because that needed a photograph of the bearer. And since she died in April last year at the age of 85, a very different picture has emerged of her later life, shedding new light on why it was that she turned her back on literature, which required her to repudiate her own books. That involved a complete change of identity, from Rosemary Tonks, the fated London writer, to the socially challenged Christian convert, Mrs. Rosemary Lightband, who lived a solitary life in the seaside town of Bournemouth, where she'd gone to school during the war for the next 35 years. There being no photographs of either of the two Rosemaries, no one in Bournemouth knew who she was or had been. Her repudiation of her work and her disappearance followed a series of tragedies. The sudden death of her mother, Gwen, in a freak accident in the spring of 1968 precipitated a personal crisis. Growing up a widow's only child during the 1930s, looked after in children's homes when her mother couldn't cope and packed off to boarding school before and during the war, she was disconnected from other people. And I think her later difficulties were rooted in childhood separation and rejection trauma. Believing the church had failed her aging, ailing mother when she'd most needed its help, Rosemary turned her back on Christianity and for the next 8 years attended spiritualist meetings, consulted mediums and healers, and took instruction from Sufi seekers. Following the collapse of her marriage, she entered the solitary later phase of her life, and by the mid-70s she was living just a few doors away from her ex-husband in Hampstead, doing Taoist meditation and working on a new novel. But other misfortunes followed: a burglary, an expensive lawsuit, and ill health. And as I mentioned earlier, polio during her mid-20s had left her with a withered right arm. Now she had neuritis in her left hand, the one she'd learned to write with. And then finally, on the last day of December 1977, she was admitted to Middlesex Hospital in London for emergency operations on detached retinas in both eyes, which saved her eyesight but left her nearly blind for the next few years. This was her reward for what she called 10 long years searching for God. Unable to see properly, emaciated and, as she said, psychologically smashed, she couldn't cook or shop and rarely left home. And this isolating experience of near blindness, which continued with only minimal improvements over many months, must have been traumatic. with the sensory deprivation involved possibly helping to trigger a gradual shift in her mental state. Given refuge by an aunt in Bournemouth, she eventually settled there, told no one her address, and in 1981 flew to Jerusalem to be baptized near the River Jordan, the day before her 53rd birthday. Obliterating her former identity as the writer Rosemary Tonks, she dated her new life from that second birth, as she called it. Mostly keeping herself to herself for the next 34 years, she lived an insular, private life, quite comfortable in her circumstances, defiantly independent, but isolated in her continuing search for God, always alert to what she called the brainwashing or controlling or manipulating tendencies in the religious groups and beliefs she encountered. Ever restless in spirit, she fought daily battles with her inner demons, plagued by self-doubt and frequent bouts of debilitating depression, which could only be lifted by asserting her absolute belief in God's love for her. And in this, she was helped by the ways in which her magical thinking had developed over the course of her later life. Birds were her soundscape, and birds were associated with her mother, whom she called Birdie. And she would interpret soft calls or harsh calls, cries from gulls and seagulls in particular, as comforting messages or warnings from the Lord, and would base decisions on what to do, whom to trust, whether to go out, how to deal with a problem, on how these bird sounds made her feel. Depression was Satan trying to weaken her, but a positive feeling from God would drive him out and restore her well-being. However, God was only one part of the picture. In her later life, Rosemary suffered from what some would categorize as a borderline personality disorder. She avoided talking to other people wherever possible because most people were slaves of Satan, and contact with Satan's people could push her into one of her black depressive states, as would any kind of stress or emotional upset. Sadly, she blocked attempts by concerned family members to offer help or stay in touch with her, finding any such contact so emotionally overwhelming that she became terrified even of speaking a few words on the telephone, knowing this would set off another attack of what she called the flood. And contrary to what everyone who'd known her had believed, she wasn't a recluse. During the 1980s, she, as she wrote, began to search for a church, bicycling across England. And just as in her London years, she continued to inhabit cafes and parks and was active as a silent, often solitary evangelist, working outside any church, giving out Bibles around Bournemouth and in London. Ordering Bibles in different languages from the Trinitarian Bible Society, she made numerous trips on Saturdays or Sundays to Speaker's Corner in London to give these to potential converts from the mid-90s until August 2012, by which time the travel and effort involved had become too much for her. And it was in 2012 that she decided she must do something about being so cut off from people and started attending open-air mission meetings in Bournemouth on Saturdays, even having tea in cafes with some of the Christians she met there and rather reluctantly attending a few of their church services. In November 2012, she wrote to the cousin she had cut off years earlier to apologize, saying, "I was boxed up under the most frightful, frightful mental pressure. I was not myself. All my decisions were wrong, inhuman, appalling. Give me time, please. I long to explain it to you." But no such opportunity was to arise. Since her death, I've been fortunate to be given access to her surviving papers. She destroyed most of her writings, including a never-published novel, and reconstructed the rest of her story for the introduction to the Blood Axe edition of her work. I first wrote to her in 2004, not knowing then that her ex-husband Mickey had died that same year. She never responded. And after further attempts to make contact, I called on her in Bournemouth in August 2006, after writing to her beforehand. And she lived in Old Forest Lodge. This is a recent picture. An unremarkable three-story house tucked away behind the seafront at Bournemouth, where she was known to neighbours as Rosemary or Mrs. Lightband. Wasn't an easy place to find. At that time, it had no nameplate or number on the door. The curtains were kept closed to deter would-be visitors, and knocks on the door and rings on the doorbell were rarely answered. Just as when family members had tried to see her on many occasions, mine was a fruitless visit, although I was able to put the family in touch with one of her neighbours, who was good enough to keep them informed about changes in her situation, which can't have been easy with her running away whenever she was spotted, believing that this kind man was another of Satan's slaves. 6 years ago, hoping she might relent and allow her poetry to be republished after hearing of the new interest in her work from a new generation or generations of poets and readers, I sent her a couple of postcards letting her know about the two broadcasts of the Poet Who Vanished programme on Radio 4. I pictured her sitting on her own, listening to poets sharing their enthusiasm for her poetry as if this lost writer were another person. Would she reconnect with her past self? I now know that this lost writer was indeed another person as far as she was concerned. She wrote down the details I had sent her about the broadcasts in her diary, along with a note, second postcard from Satan. On the day of the broadcast, she wasn't even at home in Bournemouth, but was sitting on a deck chair at Speaker's Corner in London, giving away Bibles in different languages, still trying to win converts to the faith. And I never could have converted her into believing again into the extraordinary poetry written by this other person. And I'd like to just read here her poem, Done For. That's a couple of stanzas from it. Take care whom you mix with in life, irresponsible one. For if you mix with the wrong people, and you yourself may be one of the wrong people, if you make love to the wrong person, in some old building with its fabric of dirt, as clouds of witchcraft, nitroglycerine and cake brush by one autumn night, still green from our green sunsets, and then let hundreds pass unlit, they will do you ferocious, indelible harm, far beyond anything you can imagine, jazzy, sneering one. And afterwards, you'll live in no man's land. You'll lose your identity and never get yourself back, diaboliton. It may have happened already, and as you read this, ah, it has happened already. I remember in an old building, clouds which had cut themselves on a sharp winter sunset, with its smoking stove of frosts to keep it cold, went by bleeding. And at this point, I'd like to introduce another family member. Lucy Reynolds is the daughter of Rosemary's cousin, Wendy. She's a lecturer and curator in Artist Moving Image. Her doctoral and subsequent research focuses on expanded cinema and British avant-garde film of the 1970s. She teaches at Central St. Martin's in London, at the University of Westminster, Goldsmiths College, Lux, and the Arnold Fini. And she's going to introduce Rosemary's Sonomontage, the last piece in our presentation, which she included in a presentation at Flattime House in London in January of this year, the first time it had been aired in public for 50 years. And our event today is only the second time in 50 years that this has been heard. So at this point, I'd like to hand over to Lucy.
There's no air in the workshop. We're sealed in like tin shepherd's pie. The clock is silent, but the hands go round fast with that railway station stutter. I'm late, of course. And the little silver music stand has been put up for me already. I arrange my papers. I stop being human. There's no time to make mistakes here. They're too expensive. We are setting a poem about Orestes to electronic sound. We're taking the sentiment straight. No wit, no discords. We know that however well we succeed, 50 experts, people who acquire theoretical knowledge without using it, will pour cold water on the result. And then, 5 years later, grudgingly, and 10 years later, publicly, stuff our work into the sound archives and refer to it incessantly to intimidate future electronic composers. So that was how she, if you like, fictionalised her experience of working at the Radiophonic Workshop to produce Sonomontage in her book, The Bloater, which is one of her first novels. And really, my connection to Sonomontage and my interest in it came from this image here, which I found that my mother had kept in a vial of press cuttings on Rosemary for many, many years. And I know he's been rather cut out here, but my own research is a lot around the counterculture, particularly in relation to film. And I was thinking, what is my Aunt Rosemary doing next to Alexander Trocky? You know, this infamous figure from the countercultural scene, poetry, beat poetry, well known for his heroin addiction and so forth. I was really curious about that connection. And also interested in the idea of sonomontage in terms of its experimentation. So Neil and I spoke about it. I asked him if he knew much about it, and it transpired that there was a recording which the BBC had housed with the British Library, who were very willing to take it out of its, you know, this is why I love what Rosemary says here, that take it out of those mothballs and to digitize it for us. So if you're interested to hear it again after we play it today, you can go and listen to it there in their sound booths. So just to give a little bit of information about it, that image is from the Hampstead Arts Festival in May 1965, which was really the first iteration of sonomontage, which he worked with a group called Soundstage. And from what we can work out, this did include Alexander Trocky. But the following year, I think at the request of George Macbeth, who'd organised, I'm sure many of you know, a bunch of programmes, some with Bob Cobbing, the concrete poet, for example, and in a collaboration with the BBC, she made a sonomontage with the Radiophonic Workshop, who she was describing here, also including the poets Michael Baldwin and Peter Redgrave and Paul Rocher. And this was broadcast on the third programme at 10:25 on June 1966, so, you know, a year after the first sonomontage. Rosemary, by all accounts, was already someone quite seasoned in radio broadcast. In her very early days, she'd written stories for Children's Hour, and so many of those had been broadcast. And likewise, she'd also read out other writer stories for the third programme. However, as you can tell from what I read, she's quite circumspect about her experience of the Radiophonic Workshop. So it's perhaps all that I need to say, other than to say that I, of course, never knew Rosemary, but she did write me these wonderful letters, which is so interesting thinking of what Neil has said, because the letters were very, very warm and felt very much in the world, and also spoke quite happily of her past life. So even though, as you say, Neil, she really wanted to disconnect and become that other person, she referred to the time she spent in her house in Ishgir in the 60s and 70s. She referred to the train journeys that she would take, always in relation to my own student stories of, you know, interrail travelling or something mundane like that, as I was a student at the time. But certainly, there was a sense very much of a continued engagement, even if she was never prepared to actually meet in person. So perhaps that's just to add there. So now I think Stuart is going to play. These are three poems by Rosemary, and we've had to cut out, for copyright reasons, the other poet's contribution. But as I say, if you're interested, you can hear those at the British Library. So Stuart, over to you. Thanks.
Sonomontage is an experiment to combine poetry with electronic sound. Its aim is to put a dramatic edge on poetry read aloud, and that edge is sound. What you're going to hear are, in fact, sound collages, or sound illuminations, and they've been made in two different studios. The actual sounds were composed by Stage Sound Limited for the Hampstead Festival, and the next step, the transformations in which the sounds were immersed in the text of the poems, this was done in the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Now, to composers of opera, The libretto of the opera is of relatively small importance. It's the poor relation, the music's poor relation. But in the case of these sound collages, the libretto, the poem, is the dominant partner and is all important. One of the good things about using electronic sound is that it's still in the category of musical raw material. In the past, whenever music has been combined with poetry, ordinary musical composition, I had a feeling that two strong art forms were fighting for my attention and that they were mutually exclusive. The tendency was to listen to the poetry on the music's terms. And so, as a poet, I wanted to find a partnership which was much more equal, or one with the favorable balance on the side of poetry. All the pieces which followed began with a study in detail of the text of the poem. We then tried to conjure up the relevant mood by means of abstract electronic sound. As you'll hear, the electronic sounds have the ability to evoke a tremendously strong mood in a matter of seconds. This makes them ideal for short forms such as poems. With nothing but a blouse of lilies flooding my lapel, a wallet stuffed with fever for my steak. All night until the early hours, when stowaways will grope for the unknown. And illustrate their clothes with lustrous bruises as they go aboard my boat. And all the ropes and fabrics of a boat are heavy with curved nectars in the dawn, creation glimmering and surly underfoot, and Egypt rising on a cake of opium. I went with nothing but the shirt upon my back. To cast lots with the infinite. And my bid was the bows of flocks on gamblers with a linen sail all night. of my life, and you took it under false pretenses, that piece of time.
A piece of time. A piece of time.
In the care muscles of my brain, I have the lens and jump of it. Books, thoughts, meals, days, and houses.
Books, thoughts, meals, days, and houses. Books, thoughts, meals, days, and houses.
Half Europe spent like a coarse bank note. You took it, leaving mud and cabbage stumps. My spirit broke her fast on you, and Turk, you fed her with the breath of your neck.
The breath of your neck. The breath of your neck.
In my brain's clear retina, I had the stolen love behavior.
Books, thoughts, meals, days, and houses.
Your heart, greedy and tepid, brothel meat, gulped it like flunky with erotica. And very softly, criminal, I damn you for it. And the little night shops of the underworld with their kiosks, they know it.
With their kiosks, they know it. They know it.
The little bars as full of dust as a stale cake.
With their kiosks, they know it.
None of these places would exist without Orpheus, and how well they know it. When the word goes ahead to the next city, an underworld is hastily constructed.
Oh.
He plunges into Hades, for his search is desperate. And there is Cerberus down there. That is the benefit of searching frenziedly among the dust shops and blind alleys. The dust shops and blind alleys. There is so little risk of finding her in Europe's old blue chasm, and he knows it.
Just to explain also, the other poets included in there, Paul Roche, Peter Redgrove and Michael Baldwin, their poems on the programme are interwoven with Rosemary's, so you don't get three solid poems of Rosemary's. There is a way in which the different poets really speak to one another in the way the whole thing is orchestrated. And Penelope Shuttle, Peter Redgrove's widow, is here with us today. And who knows, she'll no doubt give permission for Peter Redgrove's work to be played, and she's already given it. We might be able to make contact with the other estates and try and get the whole thing played again, which would be really wonderful. Before we finish, I should say not only is this the first time second time that's been played in public for 50 years, it's also the first time many of her family have actually heard that piece. So I imagine you're all still recovering from the shock of some of that. But if there's anything any family member wants to say, I know that my presentation on Rosemary says a lot about her disappearance and her problems, and also says before that I'm talking a lot about the work. I didn't know her in the 60s. You did. And if there's anything you want to say to balance it, because I know a lot of my presentation is quite gloomy, and Rosemary was such fun and such a wonderful person to be with, such a mixture of things. If Tim or anyone wants to say anything, do add anything. Yes?
I was a little boy in a sailor suit, which shows you what damage time does. And the sonnet montage was a fascinating period piece. I'm still adjusting to it. I don't know if it's the very best way of presenting her poems, but I think Lucy was so clever to unearth it and to present it to us today. And Neil has done a wonderful job in putting this book together in his collection. I mean, it is completely fascinating. I'm very glad that we, especially my sister Jill, was able to...